Sarah is the co-director of Habel, one of Australia's large architecture firms. We talk about how they've developed people, what the changes have been, and how having a supportive environment has enabled her to be able to have three children and become a co-director in the company. Also, how they have an employee scheme and what they're doing in sustainability, both from the front end and also from a measurability point of view. It's a very interesting podcast to tune on in. Thanks, Sarah, so much for joining us today on the podcast. Now, you are the co-director of Habel. I'm obviously very familiar with Habel. We've worked and known for each other for quite a while. But for those listening, do you want to tell us a little bit about what Habel does, who you help, and where you operate?
Yeah, sure, Seton. Thanks. So Habel, we've been in business now for 43 years, which is pretty amazing. We're now a national practice. We've got more than 130 staff and we're located across Melbourne, Sydney, Brisbane, and we've now got a small office in Canberra as well, okay, which is exciting. Yeah, so look, our practice has always been founded on these project pillars of education, residential, more community-focused projects and precincts, and I think that's been quite a consistent aspect of our business really from the early days. And I suppose these days the projects just are a bit more diverse and large scale, but that's probably a good snapshot of who Habel is and what we do.
And absolutely. And I mean, you are, I mean, obviously you used to work for a company called Grey Parkson, so quite, you know, similar to come across, but also known to being an absolutely lovely firm. You know, you've got a great culture and all of those things and look after your people. And we'll talk all about that a little bit more. And so, so you started there, and this is also a bit of your story as well. You actually started there back in, you started your career, is that correct, at Habel? And you've
Almost. I mean, I like to say that I started in the last millennium, which is a bit, it's a bit alarming when you think about it. But, yeah, look, I did start a long time ago at Habel, and, it was a bit of an interesting journey because I graduated in the mid 90s and I graduated straight into a serious recession in Victoria. And look, that turned out to be a bit of an opportunity because it was an incentive to go and explore the world a little bit. So I actually went and worked in Singapore for 2.5 years. And that was really fantastic, you know, because I'd studied in Melbourne, grown up in Melbourne, and it was an opportunity to work in a completely different environment. And I was certainly thrown in the deep end a little bit, just in terms of the buoyancy of the market there, the scale of the projects. So I was really lucky in that I worked for a local firm, but I actually had an Argentinian director. I think he was the only Argentinian working in Singapore, and was working on quite high-end residential projects. People who know Kerry Hill's work, it was a little bit of that sort of ilk. But what was interesting about it was just, you know, the scale of the projects was quite large. So as a fresh grad, you were really thrown into it, having to go and chair site meetings, you know, all these sorts of things that I might not otherwise have had that opportunity to do in Melbourne. So, yeah, sort of that. Stayed there for 2.5 years and then came time to come home and actually interviewed at Habel. So as a graduate, and you know, the rest is history, I guess.
Here we go.
Yeah, so it's been a bit of a journey.
Well, and I think that's a really interesting, it's an interesting story too, because sometimes people go off and they go to lots of different things. Other people will find opportunities and find those challenges. And I mean, when you started, how big was Habel at the time?
Oh, look, it was a very different place. Like, we were sort of around 30 staff. We only had Melbourne as an office. The scale of the projects was obviously quite different from what we're doing now. And I think that point you make is an interesting one, because I think if it hadn't been a place that was growing and changing, then I don't think I would still be here.
Yeah.
And it was really that opportunity to be part of an organisation that was always quite aspirational about, you know, how it could change and evolve over time.
But also doing it from the time I've known Habel, also doing it in nice people with good intentions.
Yeah.
There are lots of people like that in the industry, but I would definitely say Habel is known as having one of those lovely cultures.
And I think I'm glad that is how we're perceived, because I think it is genuinely the case. And from a personal perspective, I mean, I've had three children in my time at Habel. And so that, in a way, has also punctuated my career journey here. And it's actually meant that you do get those, you know, fairly short but career breaks nonetheless. And I think that has also helped me in my longevity at the firm in a funny way, because you come back and your career is sort of redefined after each of those breaks.
Yeah.
Or the company's just in that slightly different spot when you come back into it. And I like to say to Fiona, our HR manager, I can empathize with every form of part-time work because I've done it all.
Well, tell us a little bit about that, because I think that's, I mean, one, you've been one of a co-managing director at Habel. Mm-hmm. We'll talk a bit about that model as well. But, I mean, it's fantastic for me to be able to meet so many directors, CEOs and females, particularly in architecture now. The representation, I feel like, in the last 5 to 10 years has dramatically changed.
Yes.
But I think when you were obviously in that position, I mean, oh, God, I've got to do my calculation. 20 years ago, that would have been you would have been one of very few.
Yeah, it was definitely a different environment. You know, there was no paid parental leave programs, there was no flexible work arrangements. There was only one other woman in the office who had a child or was leaving to do that. So, yeah, very different environment. But I think what was really great about Habel was how supportive they were of me through that journey. You know, I think I managed to get promoted on one of my maternity breaks, which was pretty amazing for the time.
A massive promoter of that, I always think, just because if they're not around for the cycle, it doesn't mean they shouldn't be promoted.
Yeah, and I think that sort of approach is much more common now, but it wasn't at the time. So I feel very fortunate that I landed in a practice that, you know, while not female-led at the time, definitely had that openness and that flexibility to support me in that journey.
But surely that is, I mean, because it very interestingly, and I think it actually came out this week, we did a podcast with Narwick. Mm. And Catherine's CEO was saying that actually we all think that the female representation has actually gone up in the industry. It has actually decreased.
Right.
And you go, oh, okay, that's really alarming. And it's not essentially we're attracting people into the industry, but we're actually losing a lot of people out of the industry. And they've done lots of studies and they're actually finding it is when people are going, particularly at childbearing ages, and when we're having that stage in life, we are actually losing. So I know you sort of might think it's a bit, oh, it all sort of happened, it's in the past. I actually would sort of look at this situation, this story, and go, well, it sounds like you found an environment where they were supportive and they were doing what we might term today, but maybe that's not happening everywhere. And that's actually how you've managed to be actually able to get to a direct position and get to a leading position.
Yeah.
Organization at quite a fundamental, I mean, it seems ridiculous. I'm saying 2007 is not very long ago.
No, that's right.
But it's really not that long ago. But I think we have seen massive changes in industry. And I'd love to hear, I know Habel is part of the Champions of Change and has been a big part of that. So do you want to tell us a little bit about sort of how you have seen over your time in the industry? Because I think it's great for those entering, and different people have different experiences and different organisations.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And, I mean, we were one of the first practices through the Champions of Change program. We've been long-term supporters and part of Parler, which has been an amazing organisation in terms of the change. As a large-scale practice, we now do all the WGEA reporting, which has been a really good discipline, I think, and it's about challenging yourselves to improve year on year, which is, and actually tracking the data. So, yeah, so like what you're saying, Seton, you know, we might be surprised by that data point that people are still leaving. If you don't sort of record it and measure it and track it, it is hard to understand what's really happening. And that's the sort of formal side of it externally. But then we've really invested in our own internal mentoring programs. We've been involved with the Property Council's 500 Women in Property program for many, many years. Found that to be a really good one because it's about connecting younger or mid-career females into a broader industry network and actually exposing them to those opportunities. And then internally, we've had a very important mentoring program called Grow, and we've really used that as another avenue, not just for women, but for all of our staff to see that there's career paths for them within the practice. And I think that that's a critical thing, is that when I observed that perhaps my role had changed when I came back from some of those career breaks, I think it is supporting people to realise that your career might not be completely linear, particularly through those somewhat disrupted years, and that that's okay, and that there are other pathways that can actually be a great opportunity. Mm-hmm. So if I think of my own experience, it was quite difficult with very young children to be a traditional project architect and be on site at, you know, 8 o'clock in the morning, or do that, be available all the time, all day, for those sorts of construction services. But as a result, I got more involved in strategic projects or front-end projects, or working through, you know, approvals and client interface and things like that, in a way that perhaps accelerated my leadership journey. So I think sometimes there can be a focus on the challenges and the problems or the negatives or what you can't do. But I think if you can work and be kind of vocal and confident to speak with your practice about what you're interested in and how perhaps you might navigate those slightly years. And let's be honest, it is a bit messy. In those early years.
I know those years.
Yeah, you're living the dream. and that's okay. It's sort of it's a long game, isn't it? And I think we've managed to really retain staff, both men and women, because we've been able to support different interests, different career paths. Non-traditional career paths is the other thing. And this isn't necessarily about having a family. It might be that you realise that you don't want to pursue a traditional architectural career. We've got someone who, a graduate in our Sydney office, who showed great aptitude with systems and technology and management, and he's, you know, grown into that role. And then we've had someone who has got great skills in videography and photography and is focused in that area. So I think that there's a lot of different skills that having an architectural background is still a real asset for. Mm-hmm. And so we've tried to find those pathways for people rather than being too boxed up about what you need to do.
And I think I always talk about it like building a team like a puzzle, right? Mm-hmm. Is it just being, you know, often when we're on org chart, yes, it might be in boxes, but it is actually also then, I think this is where, you know, Fiona and I, obviously your HR manager, know each other and probably are semi quite aligned on the way that we do things. It's that simple thing of, if you just ask people, right, what are you interested in? What are you getting your joy out of? You know, if we take a strengths-based approach, we've got to learn the things that we're not good at. You've got to become a well-rounded architect, or, you know, if you're an architect and you become very good project leader, then you might be able to go on to more of a project manager. Or there's also other pathways that people go. And I think architecture is one of those amazing parts. But I will say, I see lots and lots of women get to that point, whether it's young kids or at a certain point in their career. And sometimes they're in different environments where there isn't necessarily that, let's work with you as an individual, but understand what this is like as the collective to be able to help you to actually succeed in that.
Yes. And it's such a shame to lose people at that point, because it is the challenge, because you're really starting to hit your strides, you're kind of into that mid-career point, and then you can tend to lose that momentum or feel like you're losing that momentum. So I think it's really critical that there's also points of connection while people are out on leave as well, like just so that they can maintain those connection points and feel that there's not a big barrier to returning. That's also critically important. But yes, I think working with people, as you say, as individuals, to appreciate that they're not going to be able to do exactly what they were doing pre necessarily. Mm. They might. And everybody is different. Like you can't come in with preconceptions, because everybody has got a very different level of support around them. You know, they might have extended family or not, or, you know, you know, all of these sorts of issues. And I think it's just about investing in that whole person that really sets us up for success. Yeah.
And that question also, as you said, like when people are, I mean, really interested in, oh, great, let's encourage you to do that, you know. And it can be difficult sometimes from a resourcing point of view because you're like, well, we've got this and we can give you this much time to do those interests. But as you said, when you've had people who have also pursued and brought other things in, it's a little bit like we just did an early podcast where, you know, the CEO was into actually jewelry making, and I was talking about how neurologically I think architects are very fortunate because you get to help. I see you have a lot more self-actualization if we look at Maslow's hierarchy of needs of sort of fulfilling because you get to create and then there's an output too. But I think it's really important for architects and creatives to also be constantly, and I'm sure you do this as well, have a lot of design type things that go on, actually enabling people to find their passions and to do that. The business will always actually get a lot more return out of it.
I think that's right. And it's something that you negotiate. I'm not going to pretend it's easy to always suddenly pivot people from something that they've become really great and efficient at doing. But it's about sort of communicating that there's, you know, a pathway or a transition period to that, you know, so that there's give and take around those things. And I think that's tended to work well. You know, we'll often have someone who might have been working in a particular sector area and they're just saying, look, I just really want to be exposed to, you know, we have the live and the learn as the two sort of primary areas. And we love it when people want to actually cross-pollinate because then ultimately we're more nimble, we've got more flexibility. But there can be that little bit of friction at the start when someone's been super valuable in one area and we've got to transfer across. And it's just sort of working through that over a period to, you know, get those business factors balanced.
I know what that's like working in a multi-sector firm when you know, somebody is like, you know, they're in education and they're brilliant at it and it's very different, you know, it's a very different cycle to if you're working on the commercial side of things where it's a very quick turnaround. You often find people might sort of go towards one area more than not, but there's not very many architects who just want to be one thing, one dimensional. They want to have multi-dimensions as well. But the leaders will then go, but I've just trained them up. Like, what are you going to do?
So, we have a bit of a mix. We've got some people who really love their sector. They want to be specialists. You know, that's great too. You know, it's just about. I think it comes back to that investment in people, doesn't it? And you've highlighted that perhaps there has been that long term commitment to culture that's come through Habel, and that's something that we're, you know, very passionate about. I'd say it's not only about you know, some of those things like project aspirations. It's also, you know, building a sense of ownership for people, literally in some cases, because we've got an employee share scheme. That's something we put in place over 10 years ago. You know, so now if you're talking about differences in Habel from when I joined, you know, it was a much more centralized sort of ownership model back then, much smaller firm. We've now got with directors and our staff share scheme, we've got nearly 40 owners of Habel. Now, obviously, those ownership levels are different depending on, you know, your whether you're a director or not. But it shows that there's a kind of commitment to the business, and that sort of, I think, helps people understand the business drivers as well and feel that they're part of, you know, that bigger strategic picture that we're looking at.
So when was that introduced and what was the sort of rationale behind? And then I'm also going to sort of what you've found, because it's fascinating for me talking to different organisations. And obviously, you know, when you work internally, you sort of know one way and then you come out and you go, oh, wow, everybody does this. Yeah. So and I think there's learnings from each one.
Yeah, look, we embarked on it. It was over 10 years ago. And, you know, we had a sort of a 10-year target to try and get sort of, you know, 20% of our staff having some sort of ownership of that at the time. And obviously the scale of the practice has changed over time and so forth. But, you know, we've kept fairly close to our targets. We've also had an eye on gender equity around those targets as well. And, you know, we're really proud that we sit comfortably in that sort of within that 40-60, you know, 40-40-20 share around owners And that's also really important. But we just felt it was a more effective way of rewarding people than perhaps one-off bonuses, or, you know, that it was something that they could build over time, so that you could start to, if you were here for a long time, you could start to be rewarded and then sort of build up that ownership. And, you know, that's something that we don't, you know, we don't pass around lightly. It's something that is a genuine.
So it's an invitation, essentially. It's not like at some engineering firms, or it might be a bit more different firms do it in different ways, right? So it's a.
Yeah, it is really. It's a more of about investing in a longer term reward system rather than a sort of singular year on year bonus sort of structure.
And I think it's also good too, because, I mean, if we think about it, I mean, like only 5% of people really become BD people. You know, or they go and start their own firm, right? So there's a lot of people in the firm who provide a lot of value who are not necessarily the people who are just bringing in work in the door. That's a very important part. We can't keep the doors open without it. But there's lots of people who contribute and do so much, but that's just not their personality, or it's not where they're going to do. So it also enables you to create.
Correct. Other pathways for people. And it's not even necessarily just the architectural professionals who can get into that sort of system. You know, it might be someone in our finance team, or it might be in our visualization team, or, you know, so it's about the whole business. It's not just about the architect specifically, which is important.
Yeah, which I really love, which I actually think is probably a bit of a point of difference as well. So that's fascinating. Now, obviously, you know, as you said, you graduated in the middle of a recession, where obviously you run a national practice, East Coast National Practice.
Yeah,
it's obviously a very interesting time in the industry at the moment. I'm a Melburnian now, living in the lovely sunny state of Queensland, but it's obviously. The industry in Melbourne is experiencing something different to in Sydney, which obviously is, you know, sort of. So I'm interested to see sort of what you're seeing in the experiences across the East Coast, and then to also translate that, because I find it fascinating. Obviously, we work nationally. There's a lot of talented people in Melbourne who can't find a job, and lots of businesses in Queensland who need to find people.
Yes. Yes.
And this happens, and as you've sort of done, I'm not saying that's the driver, but as in how you're sort of finding that, and obviously being in the industry for so many years, you've seen ups and downs, and lots of people haven't seen downs in the industry because it's been propped up for so long.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt we've been saying this is an interesting time. It feels like for a few years now. Certainly, you know, I mean, I came into the co-managing principal role in 2020, so that was an interesting time as well. and ever since, it's felt like, you know, we've had volatility that, you know, wasn't really our experience going back, you know, 15 years ago, for example. But that's where we've been really focused on it being a one Habel model. So we don't operate in silos. Our largest practice is in Melbourne, but we have a strategy for growth in the other studios. But ultimately, we're a single organisation. And what that has meant is a lot more hybrid project teams, a lot more collaboration across the studios, and that has really helped us kind of ride those ups and downs from a local market perspective. I mean, you know, the different areas have different challenges. We've obviously got really challenging construction costs and constraints around that in Queensland, but at the same time, there's, you know, there's a lot more project work generally available and the growth that is underpinning that. And then in New South Wales, we're experiencing a very busy period as well. What we've also found really great is that we've been able to leverage some of our knowledge from different studios and then start to mentor people in particular. So for an example, we've done a lot of social and affordable housing in Victoria. And then we've had some significant projects in New South Wales, and we've been able to really develop hybrid teams there, which, you know, have the best of both worlds, we would hope, where we've got that sort of local knowledge and expertise, and then we're able to bring that sort of depth of experience in a particular sector. So that has been a strong strategy to try to sort of be able to even out those challenges across different markets.
Well, and I think that's the advantage, though. I mean, that's why you diversify in sectors. That's why you diversify regionally, is to do that. But, I mean, obviously I've been part of a business where we had the same thing, one model. You obviously try and put your preferences of your resources to the local projects, but then you are using resources and on national level. And it's funny for me because obviously I've always worked nationally, right? And then some people go, oh, but you're in Queensland, so you're, I'm like, it doesn't quite work like that. The industry, it doesn't make any difference whether you're sitting in a state. And it's interesting because of COVID, obviously everybody kind of got a bit more used to it.
Particularly in Victoria.
Well, I was still in Victoria for those 2 years, maybe some of the reason. But it's interesting, whereas I run a fully remote first organization. So our entire, and I often then work with people in how they could be doing that and different tools and techniques and things to do it. And it's a very interesting, I suppose, part where I always think in one organization, but we also know then when you're building a national organization, you also have to look at it from a cost structure point of view as well. Obviously, that's where I think it is a fantastic part that there is very high caliber of people in Melbourne and in Sydney. They are two of the areas that people who are interested in design generally have flocked to. It's a very interesting thing, obviously, now seeing Brisbane and Queensland coming into its own, which is fantastic. It's a different market. There's a different attraction. It's not the same design, you know, sell. It's a lot more commercial in its approach to things and when people are looking for designers. So it's interesting seeing people kind of coming into that market and adapting to the change and what's important. And, you know, it's not necessarily the same level of sophistication in certain sectors either that people are looking for. But it does mean that I think now, you know, for organisations like yours and others, you know, I think we'll start to see instead of more levelling out across. But we have such an amazing talent in this country and attract so many amazing talent from overseas too.
Yeah, look, we find that there's multiple approaches to this, and it's not as simple as saying, oh, we'll just do hybrid teams, it'll all be great, you know, and that's going to work for every client. And we do appreciate that some sectors or locations still really want that, you know, in-person connection. They want that direct relationship building at a local level. We're employing different strategies around that. We are doing a bit more travel again to support some of those interstate projects, which can also be a great opportunity for staff because they're getting a change. You know, if we do have more long-term staff, you know, it is offering difference. I've been doing some housing in Queensland. It's great. It's a great opportunity to be in a different environment and
Different climate.
Yeah, be challenged around different, you know, frameworks and approaches and that's been really rewarding. So it can be really good for staff. And then, you know, we obviously offer some relocations if people are interested in that, even if it's for a period. You know, it's not sort of a permanent relocation, but for you know, 1 or 2 year stints, that kind of thing. And, you know, that can be, we've found that to be a really powerful way of providing also opportunities for career growth for people into the smaller studios. So I think we have to accept that it's not going to suit every client to have a fully remote team or a, you know,
or a every project team either.
Every project, And so you do have to be agile about those things. But I think we come at it from a perspective of, you know, think of it as an opportunity, not just a negative that perhaps you know, we're having to do some of these hybrid working arrangements.
Well, I suppose I've more put it into the fact that, I mean, the architects are the canary always, right? So in the industry, but it's also like, well, it is one country. You know, you moved to Singapore when you first started your career to think about these things. I think the other thing is I mentioned, and it's when people have come out in downturns or recessions, I feel like they have a very different approach and understand the highs and lows. I think we definitely do have a generation within the industry who hasn't seen the low, that hasn't experienced the GFCs and that may be experiencing a little bit of it now. It's not the worst thing, I don't think, either, because I think sometimes you kind of need to understand it's not always how the rain is shining. This is a great industry, but it also can be a tough industry. And it is just economics at the end of the day. There's different factors of construction costs. I mean, it's interesting when we talk construction costs. You know, we've had this on previous podcasts that, you know, Queensland has only been used to, you know, about a 1.6 sort of percent increase, whereas now it's had like a 5-6% starting to go down and then going up. Trade's obviously a problem, not enough construction firms to be able to do that at the right tier or competing against each other. But I think for some people, sort of realizing that actually you can't, there's not just going to be always a plethora of jobs, and that we need to work hard to make yourself well rounded and to do that. And I think that's something that you guys do quite as well at Hable, don't you? You're really quite focused on getting all your graduates and people working from a more end-to-end point of view?
Yeah, we've done a lot more structured mentoring and training of graduates. That's probably a bit of a shift in the last sort of 5 or so years where we're seeing that it's super valuable to get that cohort kind of really into a structured program. Yeah. It accelerates their learning. It keeps them accountable to be challenging themselves and upskilling on things like, you know, going to site, but not just wandering around, actually writing a report and actually being confident to sort of present back to the group, you know, to really analyze and think about what they're seeing and experiencing. Yeah. So, and then really supporting people through things like the registration process. So, you know, that's something that we've spent a lot of time and energy on in recent years, because, you know, we're seeing that real acceleration of then those graduates through. And I think that's what we're looking for when we're looking for candidates as well. You know, you spoke about how, you know, you interviewed someone who's got that interest in jewellery. I mean, we are interested in that whole person as well. Yeah. So I think, you know, if people are wondering how to frame applications, it's not just about the sort of list of project achievements or the software skills, although, of course, software skills are important. It is sort of having something that actually communicates what those broader creative interests are, or industry engagement, for example, is something we're really interested in. If we can see that people are actually engaged in the industry through the Institute or Parler or PCA or whatever it might be, you can see that there's that level of engagement and curiosity, which is what we're really interested in. And then if there are other creative outlets or interests, you know, really welcome people to show that, you know, because I think that that gives us a much greater insight into a person's sort of approach and you know, how they're going to be, their openness to learn, I guess. Yeah,
absolutely. It's always nice when you see on the end of a, when you actually see other people's involvements on their, in their CV, the end of their folio in what they've done as well. So it is, it's showing that well-roundedness. And I think that nobody ever wants, you know, nobody's looking for a human resource to be somebody. They're looking for a human who's curious and wants to be learning and wants to be the best they can be. And obviously that's very much what you've been evolving or has evolved in the culture of Hable.
And if you think about what we're going to be looking at in the next few years, I mean, it's just going to, it's accelerating, isn't it? I mean, we've got,
well, that opens up my last thing is, where are we going? What do these skills look like? Because that is probably the biggest thing. And I know I've spoken to Fiona about that too, you know, with the emergence of AI, how do we also train graduates up? So let's discuss that. Where do you think this is all going to be heading? And then what do people need to be still fundamentally focusing on?
I mean, I'd be a brave person to sort of project forward 5 years in today's environment. But
I know, it's like 5 weeks has changed so much.
Yeah, that's right. But look, I think, you know, that's almost the crux of it, isn't it? That it's going to be constant change and you know, the pace of change is, if anything, increasing. The kind of range of tools we're using, AI being obviously, you know, the notable one, is we're not going to know for a while how that is really going to settle within the industry. Are there going to be certain dominant tools that are really going to come to the fore and be more industry-wide? We're still in that very exploratory testing phase. Obviously, in some aspects of our business, it's already being used in quite a mature way. In other areas, we've done a lot of the front-loaded work of kind of getting our data organized, our systems organized, so that we can start to get those efficiencies more across the whole process. But, you know, that that we're in that period of really trying to get ourselves set up so that we can reap the rewards of those efficiencies. Yeah. We were having discussions about it in-house, obviously, as all practices are at the moment, and we were reflecting that, you know, we do need to be super agile, and we don't want to get too bogged down in, are we choosing the right tool, this one or this one, particularly when you're talking about, you know, creative ideation front-end tools, because it's going to be constantly changing. And it's more around empowering people to experiment and to be curious and actually, you know, bring their ideas to the table as well.
Yeah.
And we're here to sort of also put some guidance around it, because, you know, that all of the sort of ethical frameworks or policies that need to sit around how you use these tools in business, we've sort of tried to be on the front foot with that and have a, you know, have our version one policy around AI that we've been communicating to staff and so forth. But, you know, that's going to be a huge area of change over the next period, there's no doubt. But outside just the technology tools, I just see so much change in the approach to use of resources, use of materials, thinking about climate and place in a much more holistic way. And I actually think that's an exciting part of it's a challenge, you know, and it's been a really challenging space about how do you properly kind of calculate and measure and make tangible differences in those spaces. But I think we're getting closer with a lot of the tools that are being developed. And, you know, I think that's going to be hugely influential, especially as we're, you know, while at the moment there's particular reasons for construction cost increases, there's broader reasons why we're going to have to be much more careful about how we make buildings, go about thinking about materials and resources and, you know,
and so you're seeing this is being driven more from a government, because obviously the ESG and, you know, everybody's been trying to get more sustainability in. Are you finding this also from the sectors you're particularly in, or just a general observation that what everybody's been trying to do is starting to now actually pick up in some momentum?
I think it's coming from lots of different perspectives. I think there's certainly a top-down regulatory framework that is filtering down through those sort of ASX companies now into the tier that's going to much more impact on the kind of projects and clients we have. So that their requirements for reporting are going to come down to their for their whole supply chain, which includes us, and we're going to have to be much more accountable for how the projects perform. And I think that's a good thing, and I think you do need that sort of framework to sort of force or start to build momentum for change. But from a more ground up or a broader base, I just think you know, there's much more awareness and appreciation of all sorts of issues around, you know, country centered design, you know, biodiversity ambitions, how that links into well-being and outcomes for people. And I think that's a critical lens that we try to put across these issues. You know, you're not just doing it because a regulation says that you should be doing it. You're thinking about it in a really connected way. And we've sort of tried to think about this under the umbrella of social value, and you might have picked that up in some of our communications. And at a very basic level, that's really about the well-being that's generated out of the projects that we're working on, all the spaces that we're working on. And we find that a really useful framework to think about, you know, how we might set up project principles, or, you know, what's the framework of what we're trying to achieve through a project. And that includes social sustainability, environmental sustainability. It might be about regeneration ambitions for a site. It might be about, you know, reduce carbon. And that's something that we're doing quite a lot of work on at the moment to sort of refresh our framework. So it's a tool for our project teams, but it's also a really good way of aligning ambitions for projects with clients at the start of a project. Not every client is going to take that up with gusto, but I think maybe it's the particular sectors that we operate in, but we have had really great buy-in from clients generally, and that's public and private clients who are really interested to see how what we can do at a project level might link in with some of their business drivers around ESG, et cetera.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I'm very excited to hear that. You know, I think one of the earlier podcasts I did was with somebody I knew as a sustainability consultant. We talked about that. Like, you know, it's not just in, often people are thinking about, they were like, oh, ESG consultant, sustainability consultants at the engineering. It's like, well, no, the project's already built. This is a much larger part. Like we are talking on all of the elements that you're talking about. So it's great to hear that because that's the way it should be. And the more it is in the front end and thinking about, the more you can make without necessarily the costs, you know, versus trying to reverse engineer it. But
yeah, I think it's kind of a formalization of what we've kind of, you know, it's more sophisticated perhaps now, or the way we're articulating it is in a more sophisticated framework, but it's felt like a natural evolution because I think the firms have always been grounded in that idea of, you know, these are places for people, and now we probably think more about people and not just people, but biodiversity more generally. But then also, what does each project sort of give back along the way, both to the end users? But, you know, we've always been very interested in how a building might present as part of the city. What does it give back to the ground plane? You know, what's it offering back to the broader community? So I think it's been a natural evolution for us and perhaps quite suited to the kind of project sectors that we operate in. And hopefully that can put us in good stead when we're really then required to be more rigorous around measurement and reporting around these things.
And I think it's coming. I think people sort of are aware but haven't fully got their heads around. But I must say also then from a talent point of view and people, I mean, that's a massive attraction for certain, particularly younger architects and designers coming through. They want to be part of an organization that doesn't just say they do it and it's just on their website, but they're living it. And that's obviously what you guys are doing, is actually embedding it into your entire approach.
We were really lucky, actually. One of our associates in Sydney is from the UK, and I think that, you know, they've had this sort of way of thinking about measurement of social outcomes in place for a lot longer, and perhaps had some lessons learned about what has worked and what hasn't. And so I think that was really instrumental in sort of getting us to that next level of starting to frame it up into something that was really usable on projects. Yeah.
Brilliant. And I mean, it would be a great value, absolutely great value, just knowing everything that's coming with ESG. Well, it's only going to get more. So it's fantastic to hear all of that. Mm. Absolutely brilliant, Sarah. Thank you so much. Now, you may or may not have picked this up on the end of the thing, but is there any people, podcasts, books, things like this that you sort of recommend that people, that you enjoy or you think that people should check out?
I really value Paola's contribution to the conversation. I think the series that they have rolled out on many topics, you know, whether it's about inclusion and diversity, you know, caring for country, the sort of the champion of women in practice has been quite transformational. So I'd always point people towards that.
No, they're brilliant. And I mean, they're fantastic events too to go on. And hopefully they're on my list of people to reach out to come into the podcast too. Excellent, Sarah. Thank you so much for all of your insights and sharing your time.
No problem at all. Thanks for the opportunity.
Pleasure.
Okay.